Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations wrapped up in books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. We've got a wonderfully eclectic show for you today. Our featured guest is Elodie Harper, talking about her novel The Wolf Den, set in Pompeii in 74 AD. We'll also hear from poet Ian McMillan about his collaboration with local musician Hellaphonics. And Terry McAllister will be chatting about Crude Britannia, his study of the influence of oil on the UK's economy and culture. But we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, Elodie. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Lovely to have you with us. So it's an eclectic show. And your day job, if you like, is a news reporter at ITV News Anglia. I'm guessing you have to be quite eclectic at that, really. You have to be able to turn your hand to anything.
You do, really. Yes. You know, you never necessarily know what's going to come up on the day. So, yes, you can be doing any story from something quite serious or a court case all the way to something fun about animals. That's one of the joys of working at Anglia.
Do you use any of the things that you find in your day job in your writing?
I have to say, not with this book set in a brothel in Pompeii. I'm sure my colleagues will be relieved. I mean, the only thing you would say is you talk to a wide range of people and it just makes you reflect on, you know, that people have very different lives and experiences.
And you mentioned your colleagues there. One of your colleagues is Claire McGlasson, who we've had on the show before talking about her great book, The Rapture. There's quite a group of you there who are writing.
Yes, Claire and I are both writers and I'm a big fan of her work and I love her book. We're both based in the Cambridgeshire office, so it's always nice to catch up.
And we'll hear your first choice of music in just a moment. Is music important to you, Elodie?
Well, in terms of when I'm writing, I tend to end up with a playlist that kind of reflects the mood of different events in the book or different characters. I can't claim to be a hugely musical person, but in terms of its relevance to my writing, I definitely sort of have soundtracks. I think a lot of authors do that reflect on the book. And The Wolf Den is set in Pompeii's brothel, which is a real place that you can actually visit. And it's about five women who live there, and in particular, Amara, who is determined to be free. And she has a very complex relationship with the man who runs the brothel, Felix. He's really her nemesis. So this song sometimes makes me think about the relationship between the pair of them.
Drag me to death like a lit cigarette. Took my last breath like the smoke from my lips. I've lied for you.
That was Jokes on You by Charlotte Lawrence, the first choice of music today on Bookmark from our featured guest, Elodie Harper. Elodie is a journalist and prize-winning short story writer. Her story, While Swimming, won the 2016 Bazaar of Bad Dreams short story competition, judged by Stephen King. Her first novel, The Binding Song, a crime thriller set in Norfolk, was published in 2017 and described as delicately gripping by Sarah Perry. Its follow-up, The Death Knock, came out in 2019. Her third novel, The Wolf Den, was published last month and marks a change in direction. Set in Pompeii in 74 AD, it follows the lives of a group of prostitutes, also known as she-wolves, as they do what they can to survive and find happiness. The Times said it was vivid, wise and unflinching, a triumph, and The Independent called it gripping. I must say, I enjoyed it very much too. And we'll talk in detail about what's in The Wolf Den. But first of all, it is a change of direction, Elodie, wasn't it? Your first two novels were crime novels set in Norfolk. So to move to historical novel set in Pompeii, quite a change.
Yes. So in fact, your earlier question about, you know, my writing and reflecting my work. So for sure, the first two books, you know, I did draw on just experiences of covering crime. Certainly for The Death Knock, it's about a journalist covering a crime. And it was certainly not reflective of any real events or people, but the mood and the atmosphere. I wrote my first book, The Binding Song, really is a ghost story, and it had a lot of crime elements to it. So when it was published, the decision was taken, actually, can we turn that into more of a crime novel than a ghost story, which I did. And then I wrote another crime novel, which I absolutely loved doing. but it's probably not a genre where I had an awful lot more to say. And I've always wanted to write historical fiction. And I think it's a genre that you maybe have to build up some confidence in, or certainly I did, because there's a lot of research involved. It can be quite an exposing genre in that respect. But the ancient world is something that I'm very familiar with. So I studied Latin, and as part of my university degree in English literature, I also continued to study Latin, both in the original, but also looking at how Latin authors have influenced English texts. So I felt like a lot of the research I've done already when I came to approach this one, and Pompeii is such a fascinating place. So in terms of your world building, you don't have to invent everything. You can actually walk down the streets as they are. And the brothel where it's set is probably the most famous building in the whole of the site. It still exists in an extraordinary state of preservation. You walk in, there's the narrow corridor, there's the five cells, there's the paintings on the walls. You get a really evocative sense of what it was like to be in that place. And I wanted to write about the Lupana. So Lupana means both brothel and wolf den in Latin, which is where the book gets its name, in a way that maybe people wouldn't expect. There might be certain stereotypes or preconceptions about what a book in an ancient brothel might be like. But I didn't want to focus on the sex selling side of it. I wanted to think about the rest of their lives, you know, how they survived, how they made friendships, relationships, love affairs, mainly the sisterhood between the women, how they might have related to the pimp Felix, who is a very brutal, awful character. But as the book progresses, you understand him better, understanding more about what his life has been like. So I also wanted to think about the limited choices that people had at that time, particularly if they either were enslaved or had a history of having been enslaved. And also just the humour that comes in quite dark or difficult situations. People, ultimately, they want to laugh. They want to make their lives as happy as possible. And I think that would have been the same then as it is now.
And why Pompeii? Because you could have taken that information about Pompeii and put it in another city. Obviously, the thing we know Pompeii for is its destruction. Was that what you wanted, that sense of the clock ticking?
Honestly, no. So I don't mention the volcano at all in the first book. I mean, it's a trilogy. They didn't know it was a volcano. They had no idea that was coming. And honestly, when I wrote it, in a way, I didn't think it was coming either, because you just have to suspend that. The thing I find fascinating about Pompeii is not how it was destroyed, although of course that is interesting, but it's how much of it survives. You can literally walk into houses that are 2,000 years old and know that the original owner of that house, if they walked into it, would still recognize it. The mosaics are still on the floor, paintings are on the walls, you know, there's remains of the fountains. You can really feel it. You can go into the bar, there's the marble counter, the sunken bowls where the food would have been served. There are wheel ruts on the road. It is an exceptional place in terms of how vividly it evokes a past time. I've never really been anywhere quite like it. So, you know, seeing it, I just had to write about it. Honestly, it's extraordinary. And particularly the way that, for me, the archaeological site fits in with all the texts that I've read over the years, written by Latin authors, you know, the way that they reflected on love and life in general. The thing that was also new textually for me from Pompeii was the graffiti. So there is so much graffiti that survives. And this is an unusual voice compared to the sort of text by Cicero or Ovid or Catullus, which is elite men writing, whereas the graffiti is more how ordinary people may have thought and spoken and their concerns. You know, we get writing on a tavern wall between two men who are vying for the attentions of the barmaid, or jokes or very poignant love messages. There's just literally, you can take your pick really with the graffiti. There's going to be an emotion expressed there.
So is that where you learnt about the attitudes, one of the places at least? Because of course, as you say, walking around Pompeii, you can get a sense of how life might have been, but the attitudes at that time, particularly towards prostitutes.
Yes, I mean, there is a lot of graffiti about women for sale. Sometimes we don't know if the women that are mentioned in the graffiti actually were prostitutes or if this was a way of insulting a woman. But certainly the graffiti in the brothel itself is this strange mixture of exactly what you would expect: customers boasting about what they've been up to, you know, obviously not particularly respectful. Some of it's praising the women as well. It's not unexpected. But then you have got sometimes just a woman's name, which is how I created the characters. So, you know, you've got Cressa, you've got Berenice just written on the wall. I think, you know, writing your own name is a sort of time-old way of asserting your existence. And then one character, Victoria, refers to herself as Victoria Victrix, Victoria the Conqueress. So, you know, in my book, she became quite a forceful woman. And then other things, you know, they've done drawings, a bird, a ship, a face. I found some of that quite poignant as well. And some of it's quite funny, like they refer to one customer as Mr. Garlic Farticus. So although they're praising him in that graffiti, you kind of feel like that's slightly undercut by the name they've given him.
And Amara, certainly your central character, was a slave, captured and brought over, and some of the other prostitutes are as well. Was that quite usual?
I tried to pick routes that were known as routes that people became enslaved. So Amara was actually the daughter of a doctor in Greece. So she's a Greek woman. So she started out with a good quality of life. And then when her family becomes destitute, father's died, and, you know, her mother doesn't have a means of supporting her, she sells her into slavery as a means of ensuring her survival. So that did happen. People would either sell themselves or sell children or relatives into slavery, because that was a better option than literally starving. So that's her route in, which means that she obviously understands what life can be like. It doesn't have to be like this, which is where she gets her real impetus from to try and escape. Dido was captured by people, traffickers or smugglers. And that again, so she's from a village outside Carthage in North Africa. That again was very, very common. People would be abducted into slavery all the time, particularly from sort of more isolated areas. And then the other three women, Cressa, Berenice and Victoria, were all born into slavery, but again had different roots. So Victoria is something that was called a rubbish dump baby, which happened when people didn't want their children. They'd just sort of leave them. And people would collect slaves that way. Berenice is from Egypt and has been sort of traded over to Italy. And Cressa was also born in Italy. She's actually not from Pompeii, but she's from the surrounding area. So some of them have come from very far away. Some of them are very local. And all their different means of getting into slavery impact the personalities and how they interact. So Dido is profoundly traumatized from having been abducted. For her, it's the most shocking route in. And the others are quite protective of her. She's really quite innocent. Amara is full of rage about it and wants to escape. Victoria really deals with it by embracing the life. Sounds wrong because she's not embracing all the awful aspects of it, but she's very proud of being good at what she does and at earning the most business and the most custom. Berenice is madly in love with a guy that the others find a bit tedious. And Cressa is slightly older, so her concerns are different as well, because she's conscious of, well, okay, what's going to happen to me after I'm no longer useful this way?
And did you feel, particularly when you went around Pompeii, that life was very different to what it is now? It seems much more brutal, much more violent. But other than that?
Yes. I mean, the fact that slavery was just a part of life, that you could essentially do pretty much anything to somebody who was enslaved without expecting a huge amount of legal comeback, if any. And, you know, there's no social security. A capital punishment is unquestionably more violent and brutal. But other aspects are very familiar. That's what's strange about the Roman world. Some parts are so alien and then other parts are deeply familiar. So some of the expressions of love or relationships, yes, they were a much more profoundly patriarchal society and it's very male dominated, but people still love each other and have relationships, and they would go to bars to relax and enjoy themselves, and they enjoyed living in nice houses. Yeah, you can see aspects of their daily lives that wouldn't have been quite so different from ours as well.
We're going to hear from Ian Macmillan in a moment, his poetry put to music. That happens in your novel, Poetry is Put to Music. Ian Macmillan is poet in residence for the Academy of Urbanism and Barnsley Football Club. He presents The Verb every week on BBC Radio 3 and has been a castaway on Desert Island Discs. He's published more than 20 collections of poetry. Helaphonics, aka Helen Meisner, is a musician, promoter and DJ. How to Fly, her track with Ian, was released last month. When I spoke to Ian, I asked him how the collaboration came about.
I'd heard Helen on various things and I'd seen her on Twitter. And like me, she's an early riser. And so I always get up at the crack of dawn and go on my early morning stroll. And then I tweet about what I'd seen. And it's just a thing to get me going in the morning, both physically and creatively. I think Helen just suggested would I like to have a go at doing something? And I've always been up for collaborations of any kind. And I thought, well, all right, I'll have a go. I write lyrics for songs and I write things for composers, you know, for choirs and librettos for opera. But what I'm always very interested in is putting words and music together when it's not quite a song, when it's a meeting of language and rhythm and music and sound. This light met that light of last night reading edge. All life is bound between the back room and the edge. This light met that light of last night reading edge. All light is bound light between the back room and the edge. I always said to composers, do what you want with them. Don't treat the words as sacred, because they're not. You know, sometimes when I'm writing songs, the meter doesn't quite fit what they want to do. So I say, well, just throw a word away, put another one in. No, I'm not precious about it. And then I said to Helen, either she could get somebody to read it, or she could read it, or I could read it. Any of those is fine. So she said, well, she'd like me to read it. So these days, of course, you can just record something on your phone, which is great, and then send it off, and then there it was.
That light and this light mix their colour in the sky. That light, all light is new light, teaching darkness how to fly. That light, this light, and this light mix their colours in the sky. All light is new light, teaching darkness.
It's a fabulous piece that she's made. I like the way she's treated my voice and moved it around. And it is that thing that you always want it to be, which is something that's not quite a song, but is greater than the sum of its parts. And I like the spacious feel of it. It feels like exactly what I intended it to be, which is a sort of meeting of two different forms and a kind of expansion of that.
This line met that line at that last night's leading edge. All light is found light between the back room and the hedge. That light, that and this light, and this mix light, their colours in the sky. All light is new light, teaching darkness how to fly.
Poetry, of course, began as shouting to accompany music, that it began as a kind of expression of joy or yearning or fear to accompany music and ritual. I've always been interested in the oral form of it, and you know, I like performing my poems. And then writing historically took over. Poems written down, because they have more of a permanence, became seen as somehow more important.
This light met that light at last night reading edge. All light is bound between the back room and the hedge. This light, that line, at that line, at last night, at last night's reading edge. All light is bound light between the back room and the hedge.
Poetry has always been a performed, spoken form, often with music. Of course, the word troubadour comes from the French idea for the singing poet, and rhyme was invented as an aide memoir to help you remember what you were about to do next. So yeah, it's always been that, and I've always been interested in the voice and the mixing of the forms. I love poetry on the page because you can do a lot of things with it that you can't do with poetry for the voice.
That light and this light mix their colour in the sky. That light, all light is new light, teaching darkness how to fly. That light, this light, and this light mix their colours in the sky. All light is new light, teaching darkness.
that. How to fly.
Poetry for the voice is just the most amazing thing. And it reminds you when you're walking down the street and people are talking to each other, they're making poems in whatever accent they do it, because of the rhythm and the cadence and the tone and the timbre and the kind of shared historical moment of it, I think. Once I've written it and once you've sent it to a collaborator, then it's not mine anymore. It's flown away. It's expected to fly and it's flown. It's gone.
This line met that line at that last night's leading edge. All light is found between the back room and the hedge. That light, that and this light, and this
mix their colours in the sky.
All light is new light, teaching darkness.
For me, morning's my best time. It's the time I feel most creative. It's the time the day is waking up. It's about, we're just surrounded by rhythm, the rhythm of the day, the rhythm of the seasons, the rhythm of the sun going around the earth and the moon. The sun doesn't go around the earth. What a stupid thing to say. The earth going around the sun. Keep that in and feel yourself adapted. I listen all the time to all kinds of things, either on the radio or on podcasts, but also just listening when you're walking about and just listening. Like this morning on my early stroll, it was birdsong, and then there was just a very gentle sound of a car door closing. He didn't slam the door, he just closed it very gently. I thought, wow, that is a sound. That is a beautiful sound. So I described that on the stroll. And then sometimes, you know, you'll be walking along and you watch that noise, and it's your shoes squeaking, you know, so you're taking part in the soundscape. Yeah, I listen all the time.
This light met that light at last night's leading edge. All light is found between the back room and the hedge. This light took that line at that light at last night's leading edge. All light is found light between the back room.
I would like to spend time with a poem, time reading a book. And I calculated if I spend as much time as I want to reading all these books, I'll be about 150 before I've read that shelf. But I like doing that. I think as I get older, you know, I want to sink into poems.
That light and this light mix their colour in the sky. All light is new light, teaching darkness how to fly. That light, this light, and this light mix their colours in the sky. All light is new light, teaching darkness.
When we couldn't go anywhere in that first lockdown, I spent a lot of time reading and actually rereading. Rereading's good. I like rewriting, but I like rereading. You know, you pick up a book that you read when you were 20 years younger. You think, wow, that's interesting. You know, like, there were things in there that I didn't spot, and there were things in me that have changed. You know, a book can be a companion for everything.
This line met that line at that last night's leading edge. All light is found light between the back room and the hedge. That light, that and this light, and this
mix
light,
their colours in the sky.
All light is new light, teaching darkness how to fly.
So yeah, I do tend to read all the time. Nothing wrong with that, though.
And How to Fly by Heliphonics, featuring Ian McMillan, is available from heliphonics.co.uk. And yes, but what is this? What exactly? Ian's latest collection of poems is published by Smith Doorstop. We're speaking on Bookmark today to Elodie Harper about her novel, The Wolf Den. Elodie, reading your novel, the importance of religion was interesting to me. The temple, the gods, the parts they played in the daily lives of people, really.
Yes, you know, religion played a different role then to now. It's less about a personal relationship with a god. It's more a community activity, a way of making sense of life in the round in that way. So I particularly looked at the festivals that would impact women who were prostituted. So there were a number of festivals, the Vinalia and the Floralia, that would include prostituted women as part of the public celebrations of the civic life of the town, which, given they were very stigmatized, they had very few rights, is interesting to me that they also had a place where they could be publicly celebrated as well. And festivals could be a time of great license. The natural order can be reversed slightly or challenged, or unlikely things can happen. That was a kind of accepted part of Roman festivals. So the Vinalia, the festival of wine and prostitutes, which Amara attends on the procession to the Temple of Venus, that's also her opportunity to meet people she wouldn't normally meet in the brothel. And it's quite a pivot in the book in terms of how she then starts to move upwards through society.
And in terms of attitudes to prostitutes, is it different to what it is now, say, in current day UK?
I didn't want to dwell too much on that simply because it is very different. And I'm not an expert in sex work, prostitution, sex trafficking in the current day. I didn't research that. That's not what my book's about. But certainly, you know, you could draw parallels that the sexualization of women, the exploitation of women, absolutely. One of the major differences is that the Romans' attitude to sexuality as a whole was more open, in the sense of they didn't have the same sense of stigma and sin for the men using the brothel. So that wasn't seen as being as shameful. It was just kind of a right to have pleasure. So yeah, that probably is more, I don't want to say more open or more liberal, because the benefits swinging all one way, but you know, you wouldn't attract terrible stigma for going to a brothel. It wasn't necessarily something to sort of brag about, but it's not considered a big deal. It's seen as completely normal that men would want to go off and have sex with prostitutes.
And you do cover in the novel what happens to women when they get older or when they become pregnant.
Women were pressured or expected to get rid of their children if it wasn't convenient, you know, and even within marriages that happened. It's a particularly alien part of the ancient world that husband might say to a wife, we don't want a girl, so you're just going to have to get rid of it after the baby's born.
Well, let's take a break for some music now. This is your second choice, A Simple Beautiful Truth by Wild Beasts. Why this one?
So we've talked about some of the grim side of life, which, you know, is kind of inevitable when you think about the differences. But actually, a thing I would want to really stress about the book is I hope it's quite lighthearted and uplifting in many, many places. You know, there's a lot of humour in it. There is also love. Amara does fall in love in the course of the book with somebody rather unlikely, and this song makes me think about the fact that people can still have hope, and hope for love, and all sorts of things like that.
Woman, we don't need to pretend anymore. It's real, it's real. Let your love and be the proof. I can tell it is the truth. That feel, that feel.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
In 1960s Cambridge, you might have shopped at Joshua Taylor, gone roller skating at the Corn Exchange, and seen the Beatles perform live at the Regal Cinema. On Sunday mornings, John Gannon takes you back in time with hits and memories from the swinging decade. John Gannon's 60s Scene, Sundays at 8 a.m. on the station that's live and local, Cambridge 105 Radio.
Looking to buy a new home this summer, but it feels out of reach? Think getting on the property ladder just isn't an option for you? Think again. New homes in Haverhill and Cottenham are available now with shared ownership, with your mortgage deposit as low as from £4,000. The final 2 and 3 bedroom homes at Bower Place and Boyton Place also have exclusive incentive packages available worth over £2,500. With £1,000 shopping vouchers, £500 towards your solicitor's fees, and 3 months rent free, book your viewing today to find out what's on offer. Reserve from just £99 and find your new home this summer. Think shared ownership, think Complete Moves. Visit complete-moves.co.uk or call 020 3640 7111 today. Terms and conditions apply.
Need dropping off at work? Missed the bus and must make that urgent appointment? Need picking up after a night out with your mates? Panther Taxis is your Cambridge-based taxi firm with over 700 drivers, offering great rates and local knowledge, ensuring you make it quickly and safely to your destination. We don't inflate our prices at peak times, and all our drivers accept payments by cash or card. Book your taxi the easy way. Download our free Panther Taxis app through your app store and start booking your taxis on the go. Call Cambridge 715 715 or see panthertaxis.co.uk. Panther Taxis, your local, quick, reliable and friendly taxi company in the city. Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And we're speaking on Bookmark today to Elodie Harper about her novel, The Wolf Den. Elodie, the aim, the ultimate aim for the women we're following in the novel is freedom. And if you can't get that, the next step up is to get a patron who might support you and take you away from the brothel. I presume that was the case in real life as well.
Well, that's slightly, you know, that's where I had some license. We don't know enough about ancient prostitution to know exactly what may or may not have happened to women in that situation. It was probably further on the bleak side, but we definitely know that people who were enslaved did everything they could to win their freedom, which was inevitably and pretty much only through the route of having a patron who would buy you and liberate you. Nobody in the ancient world was truly free just to do whatever they wanted. You know, there were all these kind of social obligations and things. So once you were freed, you'd then have obligations to the patron, but you would own your own body, which is just such a fundamental thing. You would own your own time to a much greater extent. Amara is really the only one in the book who is actively striving to get free. The others, to a greater or lesser extent, they might complain about it or try to make the best of it, but they are not actively scheming the way she does. And I think that's realistic. I think most people would have felt their choices were just quite limited and you'd have ended up just getting on with your life. But a lot of enslaved people did scheme and fight really hard to be free. That wasn't an anachronism to have her doing that.
And the characters, the female characters are made up. You do have Pliny in there. How much license did you feel you could take with him?
So Pliny the Elder is a character in there. And for any classicists, no, he doesn't go to the brothel. I read a wonderful book called In the Shadow of Vesuvius by Daisy Dunn, who's a very distinguished classicist. And that's a beautiful book about both Plinys, Pliny the Elder and Pliny the Younger. So, you know, I drew on that. But we don't actually know masses of stuff about Pliny himself. We've got letters by his nephew talking about him, but we have his writing. So his natural history was a big part of this book. He has quite a distinctive voice in that. He's fascinated by a lot of stuff. I mean, a real intellectual magpie. Spoke to so many different people to write that book and just has an extraordinarily curious and open mind in so many respects. So, yeah, so I based the character on that, but obviously I took liberties. It's a fictional imagining of Pliny.
And you mentioned it earlier, but you also explore the background of the owner of the brothel, Felix.
Felix is really an example of somebody who is a survivor. I mean, it doesn't excuse his cruelty or some of the terrible things that he does. But, you know, his life has been one of violence and lack of choice and oppression as well. So he has just adapted to that and become very successful at surviving that environment. I did want to think about that. And, you know, Amara discovers as things go on that perhaps she's more like Felix than is comfortable to acknowledge. You know, they are quite similar and their relationship becomes increasingly complicated the more valuable she becomes in terms of the money that she's able to earn and the ways that she's able to branch out the business. Felix both appreciates earning extra money, but is potentially threatened by that. Felix and Paris are both names that are also on the brothel. Paris almost certainly was a prostituted man. Felix, maybe he was a customer, maybe he was a prostitute. You know, we don't know from that graffiti. But, you know, men also who were enslaved, you know, they had very few choices too. So with Paris, I wanted to think about the way that men were maybe even more stigmatized than women when they were prostituted, because they neither, or the way that I drew Paris, he's neither really one of the women, nor is he one of the men. So he's terribly isolated. He's not a very likable character, but again, he's not likable partly because of his life and how that's made him.
Thank you, Elodie. We'll come back to you in just a moment. Let's take a shift from ancient Pompeii to current times and hear from Terry McAllister. He's a freelance journalist, a prize-winning former energy editor of The Guardian, and a senior member of Wolfson College, Cambridge. He's the co-author with James Marriott of Crude Britannia, How Oil Shaped a Nation. And when I spoke to Terry, I asked him what it was about the subject of oil and energy that interested him.
What I found compelling about the oil industry was that it brought together so many different facets. There obviously was the sort of pure commercial, financial side of the business, but big oil bumps into all sorts of political, economic, social, and increasingly, obviously, environmental issues, that it's kind of was a whole world wrapped up in one that touched on everything that interested me. So I was very happy to pursue that as a focus. I mean, I was latterly the energy editor on The Guardian, but I wasn't formally a kind of energy person all my life. But a lot of my journalism has looked at this industry, which was always interesting, but obviously now is a very compelling focus of everybody's attention because of climate change. At its most extreme, we wondered whether oil was the tail that wagged the dog. Did we prove that? I'm not sure that we did. The book is a kind of journey. It's an intellectual journey. It's us kind of exploring whether this was one of the themes, whether this actually happened or it didn't happen, and if it did, to what extent it happened. It's also a physical journey, so we actually go on a road trip to various parts of the UK. We were very keen to explore the lives of people in locations who had also been very affected by oil, whether it was because they actually worked in a refinery, say, or their parents worked in a refinery, or from a cultural point of view, to what extent oil flowed into popular music, for instance. And so we interview musicians like Wilco Johnson of Dr. Feelgood. Down on Canvey Island, he was very influenced by the flaring of oil refineries in that area, and he saw it as a very important part of both his band's iconography, but also about himself. And similarly, up in Merseyside, we interviewed Andy McCluskey, who's the songwriter, orchestral man, who was in the dark. Who would ever believe that anyone would write a song, a hymn to an oil refinery, as he did with Stanlow? So once you start looking for these connections, you suddenly find them bouncing out from all over the place. As regards the core, does oil influence the body politic, and to what extent Westminster is infused with blood through the sort of transmission system? Is it inside all of our blood? And we conclude it partly is, yes, and it is extremely influential. One of the interesting things about oil now is, obviously, it's past its prime in many ways. Big oil's capitalization on the stock market is very small. I mean, when I say big oil, be it ExxonMobil or BP or Shell or whatever, and you think, so obviously oil can't have an influence really anymore on our politics and our economics and our culture. But there's a kind of hangover of that. And obviously it's most dramatically drawn out in the whole debate around climate change. More particularly, is the government doing enough? The oil companies now say they're going green. What does that mean? Do we believe them? Is it a way of slowing the process by saying, no, guys, we're involved, it's all right, we just need to do it in a more relaxed way? So these are all the issues that we bring to bear in the book. I don't actually think that there is any difference between big oil, big data, big pharma. My personal view, and I don't think this is a cynical view, I think it's a realistic view, is that you shouldn't expect ethical behavior from big corporations. They're set up for one core reason, and that is to make money. They do have to have some kind of social license to operate, and that is more where you get the contentious issues. And so should Shell be allowed to sponsor a exhibition at the Science Museum in London on climate change. And that's a big running battle that's going on now. We're children of the oil world ourselves. We were brought up in this culture where oil was very exciting and very modern and created a lot of jobs and created a lot of money for the exchequer. The fact that Margaret Thatcher chose to use it on closing down coal mines and things like this and putting people on the dole and cutting taxes is a different path to the way it could have been used, which we see in Norway, for instance, which is a social democratic country. And they put money aside from those oil revenues for future generations. And so they've got a sovereign wealth fund that's worth $1 trillion. We don't have a sovereign wealth fund. And if we've got $1 trillion sitting in a sovereign wealth fund, at least one thing we could have done, say now, is speed up this energy transition, this green revolution we need. You know, most people think of oil as the North Sea and, you know, those guys out there in the bad weather and everything. But they also created a whole massive industry onshore of chemical plants and refineries and research centers, and employed many, many, many people. And to be honest, one thing I would say about them, they did retreat. But the one thing about the oil industry, when it did retreat, generally, it paid people off properly. It didn't leave them high and dry. They were good employers. Following the Second World War, refineries that were built, say, in the Thames Estuary area, they built not just houses for the staff, but they actually built a social club, the Pegasus Club, which we visit in the book. And we talk to old refinery workers who still meet there. And we had about 25 of them having a drink with us, talking about the good old days. But that paternalistic atmosphere that was created after the Second World War was smashed to smithereens in the late 1970s, early 80s, when Margaret Thatcher came in and adopted a completely different program. And you see the way the oil companies changed themselves dramatically, moving away from this paternalistic capitalism to a much more rapacious capitalism. I did actually give a talk when we started the book very early on. The thing that everybody wanted to talk about to me afterwards was this revolving door between government and industry and this extraordinary volume of individuals who were brought into government and took very responsible positions in government. And also the other way around, when Tony Blair was in power, the joke, which used to really, really annoy BP if I ever said it to them, was, why are you known as Blair Petroleum? But actually, it did reflect a certain truth that there was a very, very close link between them. And so you see Lord Brown and Tony Blair going off to Libya to talk to Gaddafi and bring Libyan oil back into the UK. You see British politicians going into bat for those oil companies. And you saw BP working very hard to try and get British political support during the Deepwater Horizon accident in the Gulf of Mexico when the platform blew up, and the American government was very harsh with BP, and BP wanted political support and struggled to actually get it. But then oil companies are British when they want to be and international when they want to be. We are entering the last phase of the oil age, and we will transit. We have to start using much, much less hydrocarbons and fossil fuels generally. What role will the oil industry play? I mean, they are now trying to ride two horses and beginning to get interested in renewable power and invest some money in that area while disinvesting out of oil and gas. But it's uncertain. There's a lot of emphasis around divestments, Cambridge University colleges, etc., divesting out of oil companies. It's also a fact that has to be recognised that you can force BP and Shell out of oil, but they'll be selling those assets to other people. They're being bought up by Chinese or Middle East state oil companies or private equity companies, which now play a very important part in the North Sea. Those are small companies. They're very opaque. They don't have annual general meetings where shareholders can go along and cause problems for them. And also the speed of that transition from oil to a green economy. If that is not done quickly enough, you've got a problem with climate. If it's done very quickly, you can see quite clearly Western oil companies moving out of oil and gas and into renewables, but us still having a dependence on oil and gas, and where are we going to buy that from? Does one want Vladimir Putin to hold your central heating on or off switch? I'm not sure.
And Crude Britannia, How Oil Shaped a Nation by Terry McAllister and James Marriott is published by Pluto Press. We've been talking today on Bookmark to Elodie Harper about her novel, The Wolf Den, which is published appropriately by Head of Zeus. Elodie, it's first in a trilogy, as you mentioned earlier. Was it always going to be a trilogy?
Yes, it was always a trilogy. I have got the full sort of story mapped out. So I wrote book one as a standalone. So a lot of people didn't even realize it was a trilogy. I definitely didn't want to write something that left a whole mass of cliffhangers because that's just wildly annoying. But equally, yes, it comes to a resolution at the end, but I think the story is not yet done. Amara's story is not yet finished.
And where are you at the moment in the trilogy in terms of writing?
I'm writing book two and hoping to get onto editing it fairly soon.
And how are you finding book two? When I've spoken to authors before about trilogies, they've always said that book two is the hardest one because you to keep the things going that you started in book one, but you can't have that resolution that you have in book three.
Yes, I think that's true. The mood of book two is quite different. Yeah, I mean, I would hope that this could still potentially be read as a standalone, but I think it's also you have to have confidence that people will like your story enough that they will want to read book two.
A question we ask all our guests on Bookmark. What are you reading at the moment? What's on your bedside table?
Mainly what's on my table is stuff that I'm reading for book two, so Latin texts. So I'm reading Lucretius on the Nature of the Universe, which sounds extremely pompous, but he's got some interesting sections about sex and desire and love that are quite counterintuitive. But I'm also reading Cecily by Annie Garthwaite, which is a book that's coming out in July, which is a fabulous historical novel set in the War of the Roses.
Thank you, Elodie. So we'll come back to you in just a moment for your last choice of music. But a heads up that our next show, which is the final show in this series of Bookmark, our featured guest is Ian Hood talking about his debut novel, This Good Book. We'll also hear from Paige Toon on her latest novel, Someone I Used to Know. And Joanne Lindbergh will be chatting about the series of essays, Letters to My Weird Sisters on Autism and Feminism. All our old shows are available on the website, cambridge105.co.uk. And if you like those shows, please do review us on whatever app you use to download your podcasts. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Elodie, which is The Curse by Agnes Obel. Why this one?
For anyone thinking about my book, you know, I would want to stress again, it's full, I hope, of humour, of lighthearted moments, of fun, of joy, of bad behaviour. But there is also a thread of melancholy in it, a sense of time passing, also a sense of melancholy because, you know, when you visit the brothel in Pompeii, the Lupano, you're conscious that everyone who called that place home, who worked there, they've been dead for 2,000 years. So this track reflects for me some of Amara's melancholy, some of Dido's, the sense of time passing, the sense that we are looking at a time that is long gone.
Have the people went into their IAOR from the start? They didn't know exactly why. Winter came, made it so look alive.